Pianist Barbara Carroll started recording in the late 1940s, when a woman jazz musician was still considered quite a novelty. Last month at the Kennedy Center's Women in Jazz Festival, she received the Lifetime Achievement Award. We're listening to her play Thelonious Monk's In Walked Bud from her latest album, One Morning in May. Barbara Carroll also sings. For 24 years, she played and sang at the Carlyle Hotel in Manhattan, the hotel that has also been home to Bobby Short. On most of Carroll's recordings, she sings on a few tracks. Here's another track from One Morning in May.
Here we are at last. It's like a dream. The two of us. A perfect team. It's an awful pity we never met before.
Barbara Carroll, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm very happy to be with you today.
You started performing at a time when there were very few women jazz musicians, or at least successful ones. How did you feel about always being referred to as like the lady pianist? I imagine you were thought of as almost like a novelty act because you were a woman.
Well, you put it very nicely. You're saying the lady pianist. Actually, what people would say when they were giving you the ultimate compliment was, gee, you play good for a girl, or... worse still, you play just like a man, you know. So when I was growing up, those were the accolades that one got.
Now you sing as well as play piano, but on your records, you usually just sing a few tracks on each recording. Were you ever afraid, particularly when you were getting started, that if you sang too much, you would be thought of as a singer and not so much as a pianist, and it would take away from your reputation as an instrumentalist? You'd be, you know, regarded as like another girl singer.
Well, actually, I must confess, Terry, it wasn't that. I was afraid to sing, not because they'd think that I was a singer, because they'd think I wasn't a singer. And I always knew a lot of lyrics. I knew the lyrics to everything that I played. I had a sister who was really crazy about all the good songs, and she knew the lyrics to everything. She had a voice that was, not terribly attractive sometimes, but that didn't keep her from singing. So she used to sing everything. I learned all the words to everything. But I was always afraid to sing because I didn't think I had the voice. I didn't think I had the range. I was totally insecure about it. And today I don't think of myself as a singer either. I think of myself as a pianist who sings. And I have come to the conclusion that the important thing when you're singing is to tell the story. And I console myself with that, you see. I'm telling the story. And I love to sing. But essentially, my first love is playing the piano.
Do you remember the first time you actually sang in public?
I sang a little bit on my RCA recordings, which were some of the first records I made in the 1950s. And then when I began playing at the Carlyle, I was just playing the piano, and then people would always say, oh, sing it. You know, they'd hear a certain song that they loved, and they'd sing it, you know. And so I would sing it. And little by little, I gained some confidence in singing. And it's a great joy to sing.
You mentioned that you sang a few tracks on some of your very early records. Why don't we hear one of those? And this is from your 1956 recording, It's a Wonderful World. And we'll hear At Long Last Love, in which you're featured at the piano and on vocals.
Is it an earthquake or is it a shock? Is this the good turtle soup or merely the mock? Is it a cocktail this feeling of joy, or is what I feel the real McCoy? Is this for all time, or merely a lark? Is it Granada I see, or only Asbury Park? Is this a fancy not worth dreaming of? Or is it at long last love?
That's Barbara Carroll, piano and vocals, recorded in 1956 from her album It's a Wonderful World. You know, it's interesting. You said you were never trained as a singer and, you know, you were very shy about your singing. You didn't think you were very good. You were trained as a pianist. You studied piano from the time you were a girl. You went to the New England Conservatory of Music. Did you, in that sense, think of your singing and your piano playing as mismatched because you were so untrained as a singer?
No, you see, I began playing the piano when I was about 4 or 5 years old. I had two older sisters who had been given piano lessons and violin lessons and all kinds of lessons, but they didn't want to practice and they weren't really interested in playing. And I was about 10 years younger than my middle sister. I was the youngest in the family. And by the time I came along, my parents were rather disenchanted with the idea of going for all that money for the piano lessons again because, you know, they had had bad experiences with my two sisters. So I was playing when I was 5 and 6, and I really wanted to study. And I finally prevailed upon them to let me study classical music, which I began studying when I was 8 years old. I studied classical music until I was about 15 in Worcester. And then, as I say, I went to the conservatory for a little bit. I didn't feel, your question was, did I feel mismatched because I had had formal training in playing the piano and I had not in singing? No, in jazz, actually, I don't know that you have to have formal training in singing. I'm sure it might help, but I'm sure that many of the great jazz singers did not have that formal training.
I think most did not.
And I would say that, yes, absolutely. As far as formal training in playing the piano, I certainly think it's helpful in giving you the ability, the technique, the technical ability to play the piano and play whatever you want, because if you have the technique, you can go ahead and play jazz or play whatever, you know, whatever comes to mind.
How were you first exposed to jazz?
Well, when I was in Worcester, I used to hear the radio, listen to the radio a lot, and they were live. You know, in those days, there were remote broadcasts, that's what they called them, which meant they were live performances from jazz rooms, from hotels, from places where there were bands and there were instrumentalists playing wonderful jazz music. And that's what I heard when I was in Worcester. And then I heard Nat King Cole and his trio. And that was as if a light went on for me, because Nat Cole was my very first favorite pianist. He was a marvelous pianist. A lot of people remember him as a great singer, which of course he was. But for me, he was the excitement about playing jazz piano. And then after that, I heard Art Tatum and, later on, Thelonious Monk and Bud Powell and Oscar Peterson, et cetera, et cetera. But it was Nat Cole first.
In 1957, I know you were playing in a trio with your husband, the bass player Joe Shulman. This was your first husband, your late husband. And was that helpful, having a husband who was also a jazz musician? And here's what I'm thinking. Because a lot of men in general and jazz musicians in particular in this instance might have thought of you as like an available woman, you know, like a chick who plays, but we know what she really wants. It could have really kind of interfered with your ability to just play and not be misinterpreted, if you know what I mean. So like if your husband's there, then like, okay, you're no longer, quote, available. So you're just like a piano player. You're just there for professional reasons. No one could misinterpret that. Was that helpful?
I don't know if it was helpful or not helpful. I only know that we had a really wonderful marriage. He was an extraordinary musician, and we had a marriage that was unusual because we worked together, and we were together all the time. So it was really quite wonderful. Unfortunately, Joe died when he was 33 years old. We had only been married for 3 years, and he had a heart attack.
That's so young.
Suddenly, we were on Fire Island. We had taken the summer off because we were working so much, and we just wanted a little downtime, and just out of the blue, this happened.
Was it hard to get back to work after he died? I mean, to resume your life?
Yes, after he died, it was very difficult because I wanted to work. I wanted to go back to work. But you see, I was working with a trio, and I needed a bass player. And so I had to audition bass players, and it was extremely difficult because nobody played as well as he, and, of course, nobody could fill his shoes in any way. So it took a long time. But it didn't take a long time to get back to work. I went back to work rather quickly. It took a very long time to get over that.
Right. A question about clothing for you. On your latest recording, One Morning in May, you're wearing a black turtleneck sweater, and you're seated at the piano. On your recordings from the 1950s, at least the couple that I have with me, you're wearing more like, you know, a cocktail dress or an evening gown, something with straps that, you know, with bare shoulders, you know, that... So what was expected of you in terms of your image in the 1950s when you were one of the few women pianists recording?
Exactly what you said. Bare shoulders, cocktail dress, you know, a little cleavage if you were fortunate enough to have it. And that's the way it was. You know, I look at old photographs of myself, professional photographs that were taken during that time in the 1950s, and they're all very sultry and glamorous. There were photographers at that time like Maurice Seymour and James Kriegsman and Bruno of Hollywood, and they took these marvelous pictures with lighting and shadows and, you know, just made you look terrific. And it was all glamour, and it was wonderful. Things have changed, though. You know, I don't dress that way now. I don't wear things that are bare shouldered and cut out. I'm more casual, in keeping, I think, with the spirit of the times.
In speaking of the glamour photos on your album, We Just Couldn't Say Goodbye, which is from the 1950s. You're at the piano wearing this, you know, a cocktail dress with straps with the cleavage and the bare shoulders. And there's three men in suits with their elbows on the piano, listening intently and staring at you admiringly.
Well, I'm glad you said staring at me admiringly. Actually, what happened was that they needed a cover photograph, and somebody at RCA Victor got the great idea, you know, let's get a couple of guys standing around the piano looking at Barbara while she's playing. So they called in some of the fellows who were in the corridor there, and they say, would you fellas please come in and look at Barbara admiringly? That's what happened.
That's really funny. And how did you feel about the cover, about the album photo?
I wasn't crazy about it. because I always remembered the circumstances under which it happened, you know. But that was the idea. Whether that feeling came through, or whether that translated on the cover, I'm not sure. They were supposed to be overwhelmed with what I was playing. I'm not sure that that is the expression that they had.
Well, Barbara Carroll, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Barbara Carroll's latest CD is called One Morning in May.